process.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. My name is Larry Brilliant, and I have the privilege of being the president of the Skoll Global Threats Fund and your moderator today. I have some housekeeping notices. You know what number one is. Please turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices. During question and answer, please state your questions loudly as the sessions are being recorded. And at the conclusion of the session, we ask that you vacate the room quickly with all of your belongings to allow staff to prepare for the next session. Now, actually, there's a corollary to that because of the events in Iceland. Since no airplanes will be leaving the United Kingdom for a while, we have extended this session to 4 hours. It's really a pleasure to have you here. We're going to be talking today about not just pandemics in the abstract or what they might mean as a global threat to humanity, but we're going to try to take a look at the H1N1 pandemic and analyze it. We have an extraordinary panel of world-class experts, epidemiologists, who've worked with different diseases, whether it's SARS or HIV/AIDS or hantavirus or influenza. And we're going to try to understand what is it like to deal with a pandemic, a very complex and very complicated topic in society today. Did we get this one right? Did we get it wrong as a community? Did we communicate it badly? What do we do when the probability of something happening is less than one, but more than zero, and the consequences are horrific? How does society deal with situations like that? And then, on the other hand, what's likely to come next? Is it going to look like this one? Is it going to look like something else? How likely is it there'll be a next something? The format will be as follows. Each of the panelists will speak for 5 minutes. Then we'll open it up for questions. If you run out of questions, the panelists have a lot more things to say. You can direct your question to any one of the panelists, or you can direct it in general, and then I will take the moderator's prerogative and try to sort it around to someone I know who's been thinking about this a lot. I won't give you the bio of each of our panelists. That would take us the full hour and a half. I'll just give you a couple of the headlines. We're going to start with David Heyman. David and I worked together in India about 100 years ago in the smallpox eradication program. He became one of the senior most people at WHO, Assistant Director General of WHO. At WHO, he created the Global Outbreak Response Network, as well as worked in communicable diseases in general. He's now in the UK, where he's working at the Health Protection Agency. And David, it's a pleasure to have you here. Would you please begin?
Sure. Thanks very much, Larry, and thanks to all of you for coming. I think it's appropriate to start with the origin of influenza viruses. And as you probably know, all influenza viruses are thought to have had an origin or have an origin in wild aquatic birds. And these birds then transmitted in some manner to either non-human mammals or other birds, chickens, ducks, whatever. And then in turn, these animals transmit to humans. The virus breaches the barrier, the species barrier between animals, and goes into humans. As you know, when this virus gets into humans, it may transmit from human to human, or it may not, and it may cause serious disease, or it may not. But that's when it first enters humans. After that, it can then mutate in one of two ways, and either become more virulent or less virulent, or it can transmit easier or less easy. It's a very unstable virus, the influenza virus. And it does its mutations in two different ways. One is by adapting in a non-human mammal or in a human adapting itself to live in that individual or that animal and to continue to transmit, or it can reassort, it can rapidly combine with another influenza virus and cause a pandemic virus. This is why we need to worry about influenza, because the virus is so unstable, and this is why it's so difficult to communicate the risk, because no one in the world knows the risk of any individual virus. Last week in Europe, there was a new influenza virus, H2N3, identified in chicken populations. 1 year ago, as you know, there was H1N1, which came from pigs into humans. And in 1997, there was H5N1 that infected humans periodically. These viruses are with us all the time. There's also H7 and H9, as I'm sure you'll hear from other speakers. And these viruses are constantly causing a threat. Each one has its own risk, but no one can determine that risk for any of these viruses, unfortunately. Genetics tells some things about what might happen, but the only way to understand is to study the virus when it's in humans and to understand what it's doing. That's why it takes time to communicate the risk once it's in humans. Now, there are also other influenza viruses. These are called seasonal viruses, and these are with humans continuously, and they're throughout the year. These viruses, as you know, require a vaccination, and each year there's a new vaccine that must be developed because these viruses that are in humans also mutate, but they mutate in a very moderate way, and in so doing, last year's vaccine is not useful for this year's vaccine. So that's why the World Health Organization has set up a network for countries around the world to share viruses. Those viruses then have genetic analysis, and from that genetic analysis, the epidemiology, what it does in humans, a whole series of things, a decision is made what should go in next year's seasonal vaccine. This network is also used for these novel influenza viruses. And if you remember a few years ago, the Minister of Health of Indonesia decided that her country would no longer share H5N1 viruses with the world community because there was no guarantee that she would have vaccines that were made from these viruses. Now, the minister was very right in many ways. She held this vaccine, this virus, as a hostage. And it happened because her president had told her to get 2 million doses of vaccine in a stockpile. She went to a company that had used the Indonesian virus to make that vaccine and said, I need 2 million doses. They told her two things. Number one, you're way down on the list because there are many countries ahead of you that have requested this and paid for this vaccine. And number two, we probably can't produce enough for you anyway. So she was at a very difficult position with her president. And at the same time, she understood that their country, which had been freely sharing viruses, wasn't sharing in the benefits. So she raised a very important issue, which is still being discussed at the World Health Organization, and that is how to get access to vaccines. And I'm sure Seth will have a little bit more to say about that. But the other thing about flu that's very important is this interface between animals and humans, because it's not only the flu virus that has that interface. Viruses such as Ebola, such as the SARS virus, all have come from animals, breached the species barrier into humans, and then either were able to transmit or not transmit, to cause disease or not cause disease. So the two messages I'd like to leave you with are, one, we need to really worry about getting vaccine access for everyone in the world, because it's not fair that 1.2 billion out of the 6.6 billion people in the world are the only ones that have access to a vaccine should there be a very serious pandemic. And the second is that we need to spend more time at the human-animal interface, going back to understand how these viruses, like the flu virus, get from nature, from one animal to another, and then into human populations. Thank you.
David, thank you. Jeff, if I remember, you're from Toronto. Just think sort of that's where you're from. Do you remember there was a guy who closed down Toronto for SARS? A guy from WHO came in there, closed down Toronto?
You.
If you want to meet him afterwards, I'll. Seth Berkley. So Seth was working at the Rockefeller Foundation. He was an advisor to President Clinton on HIV/AIDS. He is the head of the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative. And Seth will also talk to you about other vaccines. He's involved in several other vaccine initiatives. But one of the things, Seth, that you told me, which I found staggering, is that if the whole world's direct foreign assistance is of the order of magnitude of $60 billion, we're spending about 20% of that on antiretroviral drugs for people who already have HIV/AIDS, and the total amount of money that has ever been invested in a vaccine for HIV/AIDS is under $1 billion, or about that, is that right? So I think you'll talk to us about a lot of things, but I'm sure you'll talk a little bit about vaccines.
So thank you, and I'll build on where David is. And let me just go back, because he didn't go way back to what probably all of you know, but what happened in 1918, and why flu is such a scary disease. And in that year, there was a pandemic that spread over a couple of years. They didn't have the same airplane travel, and yet it still spread worldwide. And the estimates are between 25 and 50 million deaths. So you can't predict how bad a virus is going to be. And a lot of people think, well, you know, that particular thing wouldn't happen today because we have antibiotics and all of that. But a lot of the deaths probably were from primary flu pneumonia, not necessarily secondary bacterial infections. And there's a lot of new technologies and ways of doing that, but I must say I would not want to go where Larry went, which is to say, you know, this was mild. There were a lot of deaths from this particular strain that circulated, the H1N1. There were a lot of hospitalizations. It certainly was milder than the H5N1, which had, up until that point, killed 60 or 70% of the people infected, although luckily that didn't spread easily. This one clearly has gone across the world. We've seen cases in 210 countries, and the deaths are much higher in the developing world. We don't have as good a surveillance system, and I think we'll come back to that. But I do want to zoom in onto the interventions, and luckily this particular virus was sensitive to some of the antiviral drugs that are used, and as you know, there was a huge effort to try to get those out there. It's remained pretty sensitive to it, and that's been good news. But as Larry has mentioned, drugs aren't the best solution for these problems. Prevention is the way to go. And for flu, it's vaccines. And it's interesting, the flu vaccine was made actually pre-World War II. And the reason it was such a priority is in military recruits, flu viruses go through the barracks, they make people really sick, and they kill them. And in fact, until recently, in most wars, more people have died of infectious diseases than have died in combat. So, I mean, that's the kind of history, that's across all of history. So, vaccine was made. It was a technology from pre-World War II, and today we mostly use the exact same technology. Now, just to bring it local, I actually was on the board of a flu company that was here in Oxford, and I remember sitting around the board table with my fellow board members saying, you know, this technology is not appropriate for use today. We can improve it, but in those days it was a commodity vaccine. It wasn't widely used. There wasn't a big spread of it. As David has said, it only went to the north, and even there it didn't get a lot of usage. Over time with H5N1, there's been more interest. There's been scale up in the west of getting vaccines out there, and so we've got better coverage, but not to the level that we want. And of course, there are fears about vaccines left over from concerns on autism and all kinds of other issues. So even with this vaccine, we've heard the special pandemic vaccine that came out, people said, well, I don't want to take a new vaccine, it's unsafe. Well, in fact, this vaccine is a technology that, as I said, was pre-World War II. They just drop in the new strain, in essence, into the vaccine. So let me just go back to what the vaccines are. Because of the seasonal strains, as David has said, there's a worldwide effort to figure out what strains are circulating. It's a prediction game. You never know. And sometimes, some years, they're very wrong, and some years they get it very well. But the existing vaccines we use have three strains in them, usually 2A strains and 1B strain, and that's the seasonal vaccine. When a pandemic appears, you have to go out and now change the world's effort. So the existing vaccines are made in eggs. It takes about 6 months for people to go ahead and get the strains, produce the original strain they're going to use to scale up in the vaccines. And then once you're trying to make them in eggs, it's a much longer manufacturing process. And the world, up until recently, has only been able to produce about 300 million doses of this trivalent vaccine. If you take, instead of having three viruses in there, you put just one, so you put all the world's effort into one virus like we did in H1N1, it was about a billion doses. Now, with a lot of input, it's gone up. But the point is, you can't make the 6 billion doses, or if you needed two doses of vaccine, 12 billion doses is what you'd want. You'd want to do it quickly. And I just want to leave you with this important point, which is there are exquisite new technologies, and this is where I think the entrepreneurs come in, social entrepreneurs and business entrepreneurs. There's a lot of fabulous new technologies to make flu vaccines. They can be made in bacteria instead of eggs. There is work now on trying to make universal flu vaccines that target the parts of the virus that remain conserved. And these will come. The issue is how quickly will they come? And as David has said, access is the critical issue. And there's two parts to that access. One is, when you have vaccines, can you get them to the developing world? And the U.S., when it heard that there was a global pandemic, said by October 15th, we will have 150 million doses of flu vaccine. They didn't make that date. But the second thing they said is, we're going to share that vaccine with the developing world, some subset of that. None of that U.S. vaccine has gotten to a single person in the developing world as of now. So that's one part of access. The second part of access is, can you scale up the amounts and quantities you need? If it, by the way, was an H5N1 bird flu type virus, what happens if it infects the chicken stocks? I mean, there's a lot of questions there, and people make attempts to keep the chicken separate, obviously. But these new technologies are coming, and our challenge is, how do we really accelerate them and get them to the point where we can respond really quickly and scale up and make the world's needed vaccines inexpensively and get them to the people we need it? And we can discuss that in questions.
And the story, Seth, in the U.S. is even a little bit more grim, in that over 95% of all the vaccine that was available in the United States up until the 1st of December came from one company that might very well not have made any vaccine if it had made a slightly different decision.
Well, and in previous years, we've had contamination at the plant here in the UK had a contamination, and that shut down, half of U.S. supply with, one contamination. So there's been an attempt to try to get more plants, but it still doesn't solve that problem given the difficulty of production.
Angela McLean, thank you very much for coming. You didn't have to go quite as far as most of the people on the panel. Angela's from Oxford, All Souls College. And Angela is one of the leading thinkers in how to predict what will happen with pandemics. How do you model them, and how do you think through some of the mathematical and intellectual underpinnings of it? And Angela is also part of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on pandemic risk. Angela.
Thank you, Larry. Well, thank you. It's great to be here. Fantastic first talks. Thanks. Larry, you particularly asked me to talk about what went right and what went wrong with the mathematical epidemiology that set out to figure out back in April, May, what we could expect to happen over the summer. And I'm not going to make apologies for some of it that I think went pretty wrong. I know pretty much why it went wrong, and I'll share that with you very briefly. But I'd like to start off with the bits that I think really went right. There were super papers that came out explaining why it was so hard to predict what was going to happen. And in the end, that boils down to the fact that the data that we can always get fast is how many people are ill. But we almost never know out of how many people who were infected is that. And it's almost always the case with infectious disease that not everybody who gets infected becomes ill, either ill enough to make a detectable contact with a healthcare provider, or maybe just not ill at all. And we'll come back to that in a minute, because it turns out that's been a very important feature of this H1N1 pandemic. So I think that work was really important and really useful. Of course, it's not terribly sexy. It didn't get much media coverage. The other thing that went right was the estimates of how fast H1N1 was spreading. And let me just briefly give you a single short concept from theoretical epidemiology called the basic reproductive number. And it's just a straightforward amplification factor for each infected person. How many new infected people do you get? Turns out for H1N1, as far as we can tell at the moment, that's about 1.5. That's not actually terribly fast spread until you're in a situation where almost everybody could catch it. and then that can be really rapid spread, which is actually what we saw. So those, and everything we now know about what's happened is still consistent with those estimates. So those two things went really well. And then what went really badly was the estimates of how many people would be ill. So there were statements that went out there that began, believe it or not, in retrospect this seems amazing, with the phrase, "It is virtually certain that," it was just a mistake. I mean, that was a crazy thing to say in, that's an odd thing to say ever about flu, but particularly about flu, because as David has made so clear, this is one of the most unpredictable viruses. Anyway, the end of that sentence went, 30 to 40% of people will be ill over the next 6 months. Well, here we are a year later, we know that didn't happen. What did happen, at least here in the UK, which is where I know the data best, was that 30 to 40% of people, of kids, have been infected and become immune. And that's why it stopped. That's why it went away. But of those 30 to 40% of kids who were infected, only 1 in 10 was sick. So that's what went wrong, that's what went right, and we know why the wrong predictions were so wrong. They made the untested and, I think most importantly, unstated assumption that everybody who got infected would be ill. And I think that, you know, that's kind of an old thing to remember, that when you're actually doing any kind of science, but particularly when you're doing predictive modelling, you really do need to make it clear what assumptions you're making. The bits that went right, so I told you that one of the bits that went right, and I think, you know, rather splendidly right, was how fast it would spread. And interestingly, those estimates came from multiple different sources. There are lots of different kinds of data you can look at to make those kinds of estimates. So they were verified from lots of different sources and in really quite a broad community of scientists. And one of the reasons for that is that there are very different habits in different bits of science about how you share data. If you're someone who collects sequences, you're basically used to the fact that if you want to write a paper based on those sequences, the sequences, the raw data, has to be made public. There's no private data. And so what you saw during the H1N1 pandemic was that every night there were more sequences being put up on the web. Anybody in the world could work on them. Some good friends of mine in Edinburgh here in Oxford put together a terrific website that just collated all that data, and all sorts of people, some of them more experienced than others, worked on that data, and there was a hot debate about what to do with that data. Epidemiological data is mostly not like that. It tends not to be made public, and there are all sorts of interesting power games about who has access to those data. So the analysis of those data was not shared, and there wasn't really a debate about it. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for what comes next, is that actually, although it's sort of tedious and difficult, and you have to be careful about confidentiality, putting data out there and letting people, lots of different people, work over it and debate it is the bit of this that worked best.
Thank you.
So I wanted to finish with two things. I don't think mathematical epidemiology is completely discredited by what happened. There are clear things that came out wrong and other bits that came out right. And, well, the bits of science where the data is always openly shared and has to be, I think, are the more robust ones.
Thank you, Angela. Mark Smolinski. Mark's a physician epidemiologist from CDC who early in his career had the good fortune to work on the discovery of a brand new virus, a hantavirus. He also worked at the Nuclear Threat Initiative before he went to Google. And in your program, it says he's still at Google. Fortunately, that's not true. He's moved over to the Skoll Global Threats Fund. Mark.
Thanks. Good morning. What I thought I would do is maybe tell you about a few things that are happening in the developing countries on the ground, trying to deal with not only H1N1, but pandemics in general. And that's what our focus really was at Google.org for the 3 years that I was there, was trying to put money into institutions and individuals who are doing innovative work in what we called the hotspots of the world. The predominant one was Southeast Asia, where SARS obviously occurred, and they were dealing with avian and human influenza. And I ended up moving there in 2009 in Cambodia, and I caught a lot of slack from my public health professionals in the area when H1N1 originated in the United States and Mexico, and everybody was focusing on them for the last decade about diseases emerging. But what's really great is there's initiatives that are happening where countries are working together. So in Southeast Asia, they have a Mekong Basin Disease Surveillance Network in which China, Thailand, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar have all come together to address emerging infectious diseases. And Seth mentioned surveillance, and that's what we're really focused on, is if we're really concerned about finding the next potential disease threat that could evolve into a pandemic scenario, then we've got to have good surveillance on the ground to find any emerging threat. And so that's been the focus of these networks, is how do they improve their everyday systems for disease surveillance so that when something new does occur, they actually find it quickly. And by working together as neighboring countries, they also are dealing with the same scenario and the same methodologies for determining this. And these networks now have evolved where it's great that social entrepreneurs are approaching these networks with ideas and solutions that I think has added a comfort level for these developing partners to feel a little more at ease in trying this when they're not trying it alone. So they're there and they know that they're trying something innovative with their neighbors. And so a couple of things that are happening right now, in Cambodia, for instance, there's a local developer laboratory that's being fostered by a grantee of Google called Instead, which actually was an outgrowth of Larry's TED Prize, if you know anything about the TED community. And this organization is helping local IT developers come up with solutions that make sense for dealing with their ideas. And so in trying to figure out what's happening in disease surveillance, they were taking mobile phones, which now are virtually available to all parts of Cambodia, but they were trying to get the health departments to send in when they had new diseases, but people were having a hard time spelling various diseases, even in local languages. And so this woman who was a graduate from the technology school there came up with an idea where she created a wheel, and the wheel had three dials, if you can imagine. It was just done on paper. So the biggest wheel had the name of the disease, the inner wheel had the date of the onset, and then the inner wheel had the number of cases. And all somebody had to do in the health department was spin the wheel, and then on the opposite side were three-digit codes for each one of those things. So matter if you didn't understand the language or you couldn't read, all you had to do was send in a nine-digit code. And this is an example of, you know, a social entrepreneur there in Cambodia who came up with an idea that now is allowing all of the village health departments in Cambodia to report diseases on an everyday basis. The same thing is happening with social entrepreneurs in Thailand. There's two young organizations there that Change Fusion and Open Dream, that when H1N1 occurred and people were interested in trying to find out, it's called influenza-like illness, which is the earliest indications when people, we've been doing this in the United States and in Europe as an early indicator of when there's a respiratory illness above a certain threshold. We monitor everybody who comes into an emergency room that has an influenza-like illness. So in Thailand, they took smartphones, and these two social entrepreneurs who headed up each of these two organizations worked to take all of the paper-based forms for influenza and convert them into a format on these smartphones, and now all 900 surveillance and rapid response teams throughout the entire country of Thailand in 2010 will be feeding in information for a real-time influenza-like surveillance system that's happening and maybe a model for other countries. I mean, we don't really even have a countrywide one that's effective in the United States. Ours is more done through Sentinel surveillance. So it's really exciting to see what social entrepreneurs are doing in hotspots of the world to try to help with routine surveillance, as well as there are social entrepreneurs who are doing things more at the global level, and one that I'll mention is HealthMap. I don't know if any of you have ever gone to HealthMap, but this is a tool that was developed by two entrepreneurs at Harvard, one epidemiologist and one IT specialist, that basically have created a free interface on Google Earth where you can go to that and you can see in real time any report that shows up in any web-based source of information, so Google News, Yahoo News, WHO reports, and you can filter it by specific diseases you're interested in or by area, and you can see all of the reports of any disease that are coming up. Well, when H1N1 occurred, they took it another step and they created an iPhone application and then later an Android application where people can report outbreaks near me. So any citizen who's worried that there's something going on in their community can now just go to one of these apps and send in an information, and then they aggregate it, and if they get a bunch of different things coming in from a particular area, then they can validate whether there's a real threat. But they've also taken another step and allowed people, if you're traveling or doing something else, you can set it to the parts of the world that you're going to so you get an alert if something is happening in that part of the world as well. So I think it's really exciting for me to be here at the conference and see what people have been doing in this, as social entrepreneurs in all kinds of fields, knowing that there's lots of opportunities in the disease surveillance space, and it's exciting to see what's happening, and I hope that we can encourage more social entrepreneurs to help think about pandemics and some of the opportunities that exist out there for not only routine disease surveillance, but also for speeding up critical information flow for when there are, you know, true outbreaks that require global cooperation.
Thank you, Mark. So we were pretty much on time, which is really remarkable. And now we get to have a really good conversation. And it's really up to you now to help direct the conversation. And we have a roving microphone, and we'll start at the people closest to the microphone. Can I see other hands who want to speak so you can begin to key yourself? In the last session, you had to run back and forth. So do two over there and then two over there, if you don't mind. We'll save you some steps. Yes, please. Please identify yourself.
So my name is Alan Wilcox. I'm president of Village Reach. And as some of you may know, Village Reach focuses on last mile delivery, health system strengthening. So not so much surveillance or production of vaccines, but more in the health systems. And last September, Margaret Chan, Director General of the WHO, made a public speech. And she made some very strong comments, at least in my opinion, for what the WHO might say. And she was talking about H1N1 testing the fairness of the world. And I'd just like to read a quote and then maybe get your comments on it. She said, "I believe it will reveal in a measurable and tragic way the consequences of decades of failure to invest adequately in basic health systems and infrastructure. It will show what the failure to care about equity in international policy really means in life and death terms." So in this case, the canary was tweeting pretty loudly, and yet the canary survived. So I just, maybe it's just a quandary in your industry, is how strongly do you set off the alarms? And, you know, maybe, you know, people don't listen to you next time.
Perfect question. Absolutely the right question to ask. You want to take that
I'm sure other people want to make it. Just a couple of comments. One is, you already heard how difficult it is to predict. And one of the interesting things is that countries often don't want to deal with this. So, for example, there was an outbreak of plague in India, thought to be an outbreak of plague. It wasn't necessarily even finally confirmed. And, you know, it was in one area of a big country. Well, what happened was, as it began to get known in the rest of the world, people stopped flights, people stopped trade. And all of a sudden, the hit on the economy, the hit to travel, you know, was billions and billions of dollars. And I think one of the problems is that little outbreaks can cause SARS, was not a little outbreak, although in the total number of people, but caused massive economic and disruption. So I think, in a sense, she was right to lead that charge. And in fact, she was validated in that charge because the vaccines appeared in the West. Had this been 1918, we didn't know it at the time, had this been 1918, we would have had massive deaths across the developing world because there weren't either the vaccines and the ability to make vaccines quickly, but then the systems to get them out there. So I think, in a sense, what we have to remind people is, you know, this is not a crying wolf situation. It was a real situation, and you've already heard from Angela how much the infection spread. It was a matter of luck that it wasn't causing more deaths.
David, you want to take a crack at that?
Yeah. You know, I'd start my reply by saying, look at Coca-Cola. And think about Coca-Cola as we go through the following scenarios. It's clear that there's not access to the goods that are needed in developing countries. This is linked to the fact that industry is the only group that is really developing new vaccines, and they develop those using, at times, intellectual property. And they must make a return on what they invest. So that's the model that we're using today. If we don't have that model, we don't have new vaccines. What we have to do is either change that model and get others to invest in research and development, which is happening in creative partnerships, or we have to make it easier for the Coca-Cola model to be followed by everyone. And that Coca-Cola model is the following. You go to any country in the world, into the most peripheral village, and you'll find a Coca-Cola. But you'll not only find that Coca-Cola, sometimes it's cold, but it's always, if that cap is on it, been done under quality control. So we know it's a valid product, and it's one that makes it out to the periphery, and it's affordable. Coca-Cola has found how to make the high-volume, low-profit market interesting. We need to sit down with industry, with international organizations, with countries, and figure out how to do the same.
But the rest of your point is absolutely valid. You're saying, was this the boy who cried wolf, and what will happen next time? I'd like to remind everybody that 5 years ago, an unprecedented event in science took place where Nature and Science, two competing journals, on the same day, Philip Campbell was here, on the same day, they both published front page cover stories on the flu epidemic. And they predicted a flu epidemic that could kill 100 million people. The Bank of Montreal estimated it could cost as much as 5% of global GDP. They were talking about H5N1, not H1N1. It's a very difficult moment to try to understand what, when you've got a potential catastrophic risk that could be that grave, but the probability of it occurring is uncertain. And it's really probably a low probability. But what do? Do you say, if there's a 10% probability of a billion people dying, that has a net present value of 100 million deaths? We don't have the language, we don't have the global conversation that really allows us to express numerically or even qualitatively some of those issues. But I share your concern that the next time somebody will say, oh, pandemic? I've been through a pandemic, like people did in Katrina. Hurricane? I've been through a hurricane. I'll stay here. Next question.
My name's Dorje Mundell. I work for Novartis, one of the vaccine producers. I'm not a vaccine specialist, but just to follow up on this point on the boy who cried wolf, I think it's clear that this was a genuine threat of kind of huge uncertainty and had to be treated in the most serious ways. It's very concerning, the level of public opinion and the cynicism and skepticism that now exists. And if you take, for example, H5N1 with its 60 to 70% mortality, as you mentioned, combined with the spread of H1N1, and then you look at the fact, I'm told by my colleague Rino Rapuoli, that in Egypt there are a number of communities where they've got coexistence of these strains in the same people at the moment. So anything is possible. This really is a potential time bomb. So it's not just a theoretical thing. All the preconditions are there. So how do we do the public communication piece, the sensitization? That's one piece. And then how do we adjust the WHO processes? Because that's one of the things that triggered the skepticism, because we got up to level 5 threat so quickly, partly because the system, the protocols, have been geared around the potential threat of an H5N1, kind of that kind of severe mortality situation, which what we got was the inverse of relatively low mortality and high spread. So how do we recalibrate the WHO processes so that it's more flexible and can cope more appropriately with the range of possible future outbreaks?
Well, that's an excellent question. Panelists, who would like to take that?
David's probably the right person to answer that from the WHO's perspective, but I will tell you, living in Southeast Asia, where H5N1 is a daily concern among farmers and public health professionals, and then when H1N1 did occur, I mean, that was there. You know, it's interesting. We talk about cynicism, you know, maybe here in Europe and the U.S. There was no cynicism in Southeast Asia, let me tell you. People were very concerned about crossing over and the fact that you could take this H1N1, which clearly had rapid spread, and I think the WHO system monitored that, and that's why it moved up. It didn't have the severity scale as part of that system necessarily, but it was saying that this is now moving through these phases and it becomes a pandemic. So in Southeast Asia, they were more concerned about what could happen if these cross over, and they were concerned about this thing that they saw spreading very quickly, and knowing that they had a disease that had high severity, and if those combine, which, you know, is still something that is possible. But you do raise an interesting point that did happen in Southeast Asia because of the elevation of the WHO scale, is we had people in the ministries of health who were getting hammered by their presidents who, you know, as they had proposed the plan, knew that all these things had to get implemented if it got to level 5 or level 6. And when these presidents were not seeing the severity of the illness, they were questioning the public health system of like, well, what does this really mean and what's this going to mean in the future? So yes, it did have implications, I think, outside of the health community about what that means. But I think there's certainly a different milieu about how people feel about these things in parts of the world than we may be seeing here.
We actually have a series of common denominators. I want to take it out of health for just a second, because whether it's Y2K or it's climate change, mm-hmm. or it's the economic catastrophe that we've just been through, or it's pandemics of various stripes, we have some issues in communicating risk. It's an entire field that, as globalization has occurred, the globalization of the concept of communicating widespread risk has not evolved as fast. Sorry,
Seth.
I was
just going to add one little point, which is interesting. So physicians, you would expect to be the people who would be first adopters. And what happened with this pandemic is seasonal flu vaccines went up for physicians. So something like 60% of physicians got the seasonal vaccine, but only about 30% got the pandemic vaccines. And it's, in a sense, exactly what the opposite you'd expect, and it's irresponsible. Why is it irresponsible? All right, a physician can say, I make a choice of whether I'm going to get disease or not, but they can be infectious with that disease before they're symptomatic and after symptomatic, and, you know, perhaps during the illness. And so here they were, you know, voting in essence with their feet and not getting the vaccines they should.
Right? Okay. And can I see a hand over there? And while you're walking over there, David will also chime in on this.
I'd just like to say that I think WHO did get it completely right. We don't know what these viruses will do. What happened was the risk communicators didn't get it right. What their communication should be is vaccine is an insurance policy, mm-hmm. and that's it. And if you have to have an insurance policy, every country has to have that insurance policy.
Please.
Yes, I'm Andrea Coleman from Riders for Health. I was very interested to hear what you all said about the role of social entrepreneurs in this clinical development, really, and your observations and perspectives on pandemics. And I was interested in what Mark said about new technology, but I really want to speak up for old technology, because the vehicles that are going to be so fundamental to delivering health and in pandemics is going to be critical, and they're very expensive, and they need to be managed, and the resources need to be managed. And I'd just like to make sure that people really have that part of the puzzle very high on the agenda, because you can do everything you can do, but if they don't reach those people, and supply chain logistics and transport management and the resources are so important. So
thank
it's
you,
more
thank,
of a comment.
Thank you. It was, but it was a good one. Thank you very much. And now, a question? Why don't you stay over on that side to save your legs?
Thank you. I'm Sarah McGeehan from the Young Foundation, and I'm working on health innovation in the UK, particularly around service delivery. It's been a fascinating morning so far, so I wanted to thank you all and ask you your reflections on a slightly different challenge I think we're facing, which is around hospital superbugs So we've talked a lot this morning about the infrastructure and the technological and vaccine responses to pandemics. And arguably, we don't have those solutions in hospital superbugs. We have a different challenge, which is to try and get clinicians and health workers to do things that we know make sense when it comes to tackling superbugs, and they just don't do. And I just wondered what your reflections would be on trying to make that more effective as a strategy.
We used to call them nosocomial infections because we never wanted to say doctor-caused infections. Does anybody want to take that one on?
Yeah.
David?
You know, I think that what's going on here in the UK is very pertinent to this because, you know, the Sanger Institute and the genomics that are going on are actually adding very much to trying to understand where resistant infections in hospitals are coming from through genetic tracing and studying, and also then to act on that. So modern technologies are very important to finally solve this problem. And, you know, if you can get into a hospital and you can identify an organism and you can see from where that organism came by looking genetically at organisms elsewhere, you can begin to go back and get to the source and stop it. And that's what's happening now with coming together of many different agencies in the UK.
And I, just as an aside, when I was a medical student, I remember one morning, I'm not a morning person, and going up to some little old lady and being completely disheveled and not having a tie on and having the lady look up at me and say, you know, I don't even believe you're a doctor. I don't have faith in you. And I remember being devastated. And from that day on, you know, I wore a tie. I was very careful. Well, they just did a study looking at this, and it turns out ties that you drag over the patient when you're visiting them are ways to transmit infections. And so there's been now a movement to try to ban ties for doctors in hospitals. So
last year we had a pandemic panel like this, and Nathan Wolf, who's sitting there, was on the panel, and he talked about the fact that there are 3 or 4 dozen new emerging communicable diseases that will be the next batch of pandemic risks. Maybe Nathan, you could ask Mark a question about that. If you give him a microphone and enough time, he'll ask him something.
Before he does that, though, I just want to make a comment. You know, it's not only the hospital infection. You know, I worry a great deal about drug resistance, period. And I think you only had to look at the H1N1 pandemic and do a little survey of those who you know and ask how many people took antibiotics during that, because people still have this perception that they need antibiotics for a viral illness. And, you know, maybe somebody from the pharmaceutical companies can speak up, but as far as I know, there are no new classes of antibiotics in development. And, you know, what we have is what we have. And we really need to protect those drugs that we have for when you do have a serious bacterial infection and you need that. And somehow, you know, we talk about risk communications for lots of things on pandemics. We still have not got that message across about the, you know, prudent use of antibiotics and protecting those that we need to avoid drug resistance.
Perhaps for full disclosure before I start, I should say that my organization, Global Viral Forecasting, is supported by Skoll Foundation and Google.org when Larry and Mark were there as well.
Does that mean you're going to pull your punches in the question?
Well, I'm just trying to make sure that people don't think people were seated in the audience to be asking questions. But what I will say is that I think we often forget with H1N1 that we just witnessed a biologically very, very significant event. I mean, we went from a situation where we had a virus that had affected virtually no one to a situation where within a year this virus spread and affected a sizable percentage of the world's population. And I think the notion that we somehow did anything to really stop the spread of this is pretty crazy. I mean, basically, these vaccine strategies, we did not have vaccines in time to address this. We got lucky that the sort of severity dial that nature set on this particular virus was particularly low. Otherwise, we'd be in a situation where we wouldn't be talking about the eruption in Iceland. We'd all still be talking about the deaths that were occurring even right now with H1N1, which we see still ongoing in sites and even middle of Central Africa and forest areas. So I just from my own perspective, reiterating this issue of risk literacy. And I think we get sort of stopped in this notion of saying, okay, we need scientific literacy, we need people to understand more what's going on, and that would certainly be wonderful, but I think the most important thing is people should understand in a basic way what's going on with these, and we need to get very good about communicating this. The notion that WHO was absolutely on top of this virus, I mean, thank God that was the case. This thing, if it was even nominally more deadly, would have been devastating. But on the other hand, people see this as somehow, they just don't get it. They don't get the importance of H5 or H1, and I think, you know, partially
this is that their fault, or did we do a bad job communicating? I think really, in the end, you can't blame the public, because the public has been given a lot of information, and some of it was misleading, and it wasn't deliberately misleading. It was just we didn't communicate it. All the probabilities.
Healthcare workers didn't even respond. That's the point. I mean, the most educated.
Mm. I think we have a real problem with being measured and clear about what we do and don't know, without being narcoleptically boring. That's the fundamental problem, and I totally agree with you, Nathan. That's our problem. It's not the media's problem. It's not the public's problem. It's something we desperately need to learn.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Angela, you've commented on this, that I think with hurricanes, for example, people don't blame the meteorologist. If, you know, you're following a hurricane and it takes a turn in the other direction, it doesn't hit, you're happy that people were actually monitoring the movement of the hurricane. And I think, Angela, you've said this before, which is part of our problem, that these are not more frequent, and sadly, and I think this sort of echoes the importance of urgent threats, et cetera, is that we're going to see more and more of these. We may sadly end up being in a situation where they are equally common, but until that happens, how do we address that these things are rare from time to time, but if we don't follow them, it's sort of at our own peril.
Let's go. Jeff, over here, and then over there.
Thank you, Larry. I don't really have a question so much as an announcement, because it isn't widely known, but Participant, which, as you know, is a media company and did films like An Inconvenient Truth and a couple of the films that have been here at the forum, Countdown to Zero and Oceans, we have just signed a deal with Warner Brothers where we're doing a film called Contagion, with Matt Damon and Jude Law and Gwyneth Paltrow. Steven Soderbergh is directing. We start shooting that this year, and it should be out next year sometime. And the intent is to communicate to the public what the risks are with pandemics. And, you know, imagine if H1N1 had been more deadly, just what the world would be like. That's basically the premise of the film, and people like Nathan and Larry were consulted for this. So, I'm all ears to hear more about messaging to the public and what we have to do, because it seems like that public will is so important.
And Matt is playing David Heyman, isn't he? Actually, I think David Heyman should play Matt.
Hi, Jason Saul from Mission Measurement. I just wanted to pick up on this the comment you made earlier, Larry, about risk, and specifically the calculus of risk. In law, they have a concept called the calculus of risk, and you look at the cost of prevention versus the actual value of damages. And I know when we were in policy school, we studied that the policy-making decision around when you issue a vaccine has to weigh the potential cost, if you know that 0.1% of 250 million people will die if you issue a vaccine, versus the actual lives saved. So I'm interested, both from a mathematical as well from a policy perspective, how do you calculate the risk when you issue a vaccine versus the percentage that you know will actually have attrition from it?
Good question. Angela, you want to take that one?
If you knew those things, calculating the risk is straightforward. The problem is you don't know. So even, up until September this year in this country, we did not know how many children had been infected. We knew how many had been very sick. We had a reasonable idea of how many had been a bit sick. We just had no idea how many were already immune. And in fact, I had to eat my hat, because somebody who I suspected had a sneak peek at the data told me it was going to be 25%, and I said, no way. And it was. So, I mean, if you don't have the basic data, then you have to move to different ways of making decisions about risk that do not rely on multiplying numbers together. Because multiplying numbers together when you are just making the numbers up, in my view, is a bad move.
They do have the data on how many people will die, though, from the issue of a vaccine that are false positive, whatever it is, right?
Well, hang on a minute. We did not know in September. I mean, even in September, when we'd already had one wave here, we had no idea how many cases there would be through the autumn. So even if we'd known all sorts of things, like how many vaccine-related deaths might there be, we could not have made a sensible cost-benefit calculation because we had no idea how many cases we might prevent. I don't think that means you can't have the discussion, but I feel quite passionately that one must be absolutely honest about the things you don't know.
And just to add to this, I mean, you know, the problem is health sector is very different than, let's say, defense sector. So how much are we spending in defense on the risk here in the UK, on the risk that the UK is going to be attacked? What's the probability of that occurring? Now, it's catastrophic if it occurs, but that gets spent. There is going to be a huge debate now for all the countries that ordered flu vaccine. And, you know, they'd ended up not having or not using it. They probably still should use it because, as Nathan mentioned, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if there's going to be a third wave. We don't know if this is going to change. But there is going to be that debate. And the money is trivial, absolutely trivial. But one of the problems on the corporate side is companies, you know, are for profit. They have to make decisions. They have to decide how much they scale based upon what the world demand's going to be. And then, you know, how much is going to be purchased. And for the developing world, you know, huge debate. Do you step up to the plate and buy lots of it and find out later it's not there? And so we have to do, as David said, a much better job in figuring all this out. And I just one last point and go back to HIV, where we really didn't do a very good job early on in the pandemic in talking about what worked, what didn't work. Because of the stigma, because of the denialism, there was a lot of debate on how to intervene early on. A lot of, we know exactly how to prevent this disease, you know, just say no, abstinence, all of this other misinformation. And the truth is, these are very complicated behaviors. So we got to get a lot better at managing those behaviors like we do with superinfections.
Mitch Besser, Mothers to Mothers. What are the timelines from the time that, you know, prediction, production, distribution, getting the vaccine to the people in the field? You know, what kinds of systems are in place to deliver it to people? Andrea made comments about supply chain, but you look at countries like Nigeria, I mean, the largest country on the continent, where they've still made very few inroads with HIV despite 25 years of promotion. What's it going to take to get enough vaccine into the field to create herd immunity? Over how long a period of time, and will we be able to keep pace with the rate at which this virus is going to infect people?
Well, this technology, you can't do it. And the reason is that it takes so long to produce the egg-based. It's a separate issue on how quickly you can get the first dose, which still takes a long time. New technology, it can be done, but then you've got the delivery problem, and the delivery problem is common to all vaccines and drugs as well. It needs to be fixed.
And it depends on the disease and the public will about the disease. Maybe David would talk a little bit about polio in Nigeria.
Yeah, I'll talk about two things. I'll just say that for flu, the Holy Grail is a vaccine which will protect against everything we know and don't know
right.
by looking in all the different influenza strains that we do know, because we know there are a lot of different strains in wild aquatic birds. Find the areas on the virus which will cause immunity for every virus. So that's the answer to how do you get the vaccine issue solved, and that's what science is working towards. As far as getting these goods out, you know, a country, if it really is engaged, can get the goods out. When there's a yellow fever outbreak in Nigeria, Nigeria gets the vaccine to the people, and they get support from WHO, from UNICEF, from Doctors Without Borders, from the Red Cross and Red Crescent, a whole society, a whole group of different groups. But they're not ready on a day-to-day basis, and that's what you're talking about. And the dilemma here is the following. Donor agencies, development agencies, will be happy to give money to strengthen health systems. They're not happy to give money to deal with epidemics or pandemics until that's happened. And then they go into a different budget, which is their humanitarian budget, and they give money to respond. Instead of preparing through development funds, they respond. And so that whole mentality has to be shifted. The paradigm has to go back to preparing for epidemics as a usual development activity and not a humanitarian event.
Well, I just wanted to remind everybody of a little bit of hidden, I think, really good news in what just happened with H1N1, which was the lack of cases in people over 65. So people who'd had the old H1N1 that circulated, I guess, until 1957, were almost completely protected against this flu. And that is extremely exciting news from the point of view of a one-shot flu vaccine one day. If it can occur naturally, in my view, there's much more hope that you could induce it with a vaccine.
Peter, then Sam.
So this is just a quick informational question. Do we know how effective, for example, the seasonal vaccine is at actually preventing or reducing illness? Do we know that H1N1 didn't turn out to be that lethal, although it spread very quickly. We sort of know who got the vaccines and who didn't. Do we know how effective that was at reducing either infection or illness? And is that helpful for Angela for the modeling in the future of integrating who's going to get sick, who's going to get infected, who's going to get sick, where the limited amount of vaccine ought to go?
Let me answer, then I'll ask David to comment a bit too. But we know in retrospect. And we know all the things that you've been asking about each disease better through the retrospectoscope than we do prospectively. In smallpox, which killed 500 million people in the last century, 500 million, we know the case fatality rate was about 30-35%. We know the vaccine efficacy rate was probably over 85, might have been over 90%. We know the death rate from vaccination was probably about 1 or 2 per million vaccinated. Now, if we give all that information to Angela, she'd do a really good job of modeling smallpox. But we don't have any more smallpox. And we don't have that information prospectively to any of the 30 new emerging communicable diseases that have occurred in the last 30 years. And we never know that about the most fluid of all diseases, which is influenza. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, just to add to that, as Larry said earlier, influenza vaccine was developed back in the back in the 40s, late 40s, 50s. That was before they needed to prove efficacy to license a vaccine. You know, all that data now would be available, but it wasn't available then. And it's never been collected, and there still is debate about the effectiveness of the seasonal vaccine.
Well, and just a couple of more points on that. So it was actually 38 when they developed
38.
It.
38. Salk, and it was Salk, wasn't it?
The vaccine itself is, if it's perfectly matched. Now, the problem is growing in eggs, you sometimes can't grow the exact strain. So it's interesting. This first, when the H1N1 came up, people predicted, one of the reasons they predicted they could get so many doses so quickly was they thought it was going to grow. They could get a couple of doses of vaccine per egg. They ended up with 0.9 at the beginning. So it grew slowly. What they do is they adapt the strains to try to get ones that grow. When they do that, sometimes they can get a little bit of an immunologic mismatch. So what you'd want in the future is either a universal vaccine that covers all the strains, or you'd want to use the actual strains, because then you'd expect a high efficacy. Last is that the elderly, which of course is the normal risk for seasonal vaccine, it's lousy in the efficacy. People don't want to do. There is now a big study that's beginning to look, but it's not well done. They just licensed a new vaccine, four times the dose. They're getting better efficacy in the elderly, but still not that good. And again, this can be solved with better technology, so it's changing. Yeah.
One question from PBS.
Thank you. Fred DeSam Lazaro from the NewsHour. I was just in Cambodia last year doing a story about the emerging threat of drug-resistant malaria. And one of the things that impressed me was how the fake drug makers from China were able to adopt the Coca-Cola strategy in the farthest corners of Cambodia. I'm just wondering, since you live in the shadow of the world's biggest manufacturing power, why China might not be more tapped for that power in producing more vaccines?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. It might be more for Seth, but China is an interesting place in watching them evolve through this partnership with the other five countries in Southeast Asia. And I think that they've certainly been playing a leadership role in some of the laboratory technology and in some of the surveillance. After SARS, you know, China probably has one of the best influenza-like surveillance systems, but we've never seen it. But certainly, we actually know it's happening because they'll show it to you if you're there. And I think that, you know, I've always thought that health is a great tool of diplomacy. Certainly in 2003, when I had the opportunity to help create a disease surveillance system between Israel, Palestine, and Jordan that is going on to this day, you can see where you can take something that matters to everybody. So maybe in that respect, with China now fully integrated through this partnership on disease surveillance, maybe they will step in and play that role. But, you know, I'm not a vaccine expert, and I don't know much about the manufacturing capabilities there.
Let me
but,
just give you yeah. two bits on that. Well, so China produces lots of vaccines for China, and the quality of those vaccines have not necessarily been at the highest standards. India had made a real movement to try to get to world-class quality, and they supply now large percentage of the world's vaccines. What they don't have is capabilities in innovation for new vaccines. They're just developing that now. A lot of that had to do with IP and other issues. And one of the things that WHO has done over time is lifted up the regulatory agencies to make sure that the quality of vaccines is at a level that, you know, can be used across different countries. And I think you're going to see more and more of these vaccines being done in the developing world. And lastly, what's really interesting with the economic shift that occurred now, some of the biotech companies that have traditionally gone to Western companies are now reaching out directly to developing country manufacturers to drive forward. Some of the new technologies for flu are actually being produced in India and are going towards licensing in India quicker than they're going in the West because of the interest in trying to get new technology.
David and then Ian.
You know, I just would add to what Seth said. Producing vaccine is not the only issue. It's regulating that vaccine and making sure that every lot of vaccine that's developed is tested in a decent laboratory. I was just in a country where the Minister of Health said to me, I'm in a dilemma. I can't raise the standards in my regulatory agency because when I raise them a bit higher, then the agency can collect more corrupt money to give that license. And so it's a real complicated issue. It's not just an issue of producing vaccine. It's making sure that regulatory agencies are able to quality control, but also that they're not corrupt. So it's a very, very, very difficult issue.
Ian, just a second. I didn't realize we had another question over here.
Hi, Shevani Rivas from water.org. So we're monopolizing the microphone over here. There's a lot of energy and excitement in this corner. I actually had the opportunity to work with the CDC this past year on sort of the federal government's national awareness response. We did a lot of research and evaluation on public opinion and what people's thoughts and perceptions were of vaccination. There's a lot of misinformation out there, but I think there's also a lot of correct information out there, and people are talking. I think social consciousness is definitely rising, and people are talking about vaccines. They're understanding a lot more of sort of the complications. So you have this interesting tension where people are more educated, yet they're not getting vaccinated at the rates that we'd like. Sort of building on your comment about healthcare workers, right? Healthcare practitioners are not getting vaccinated at the rates we'd like to see. There's actually an issue in New York where healthcare providers, there was a hospital that tried to require healthcare providers to get vaccinated. So my question is around policy, and should we be thinking and moving in that direction around making this a requirement, making this mandatory vaccination? Because from where I stand and sort of from what I understand, we're not entirely sure. Influenza changes each year on the seasonal front. So do we know enough to start moving in that direction? And I'm thinking polio, you know, and other, diseases where we have gone in that direction and it's made a big difference. So from a public awareness perspective, I think consciousness is definitely better than years prior, but I just don't know at this point, are we ready to start moving in that direction? I mean, the legislation ultimately said you cannot require people to be vaccinated. And I agree with you that to some case it's irresponsible. In some cases, it's irresponsible for healthcare providers not to be vaccinated. So I'm also torn on this issue and wondering if you have any thoughts on sort of policy and regulation.
And you're speaking specifically now about influenza vaccines.
Yes,
Yeah. I would mandate it for healthcare workers. And when there's pandemic flu, certainly. Seasonal is a different story. But I would mandate it under those circumstances. And I think you're right. The way we controlled infectious diseases ultimately was by going out and getting people vaccinated. And, you know, to have 70% of healthcare workers not vaccinated when there's a pandemic going on, to me, is a disgrace. But
you know, one of the nice things about British colonialism is that it left in India and Pakistan and Burma and Bangladesh the 1895 Bengal Immunity Act, which required vaccination, obligatory by law, against five of the worst diseases under penalty of 30 years in prison. I'm not necessarily recommending that for influenza. Ian?
So, Ian Golden, James Martin, 21st Century School at Oxford. We work across a number of areas, and Angela directs our Emerging Infections Group, but we work on finance and we work in different areas. And one of the observations is that the nature of systemic risk across the board is changing. And I'd like to ask the panel two questions in this respect. First is, do you see going forward a very different nature of the spread of pandemics due to the integrations from globalization, physical proximity, opening up, as well as technological change? And the technological change piece is, are you worried about new things that are biopathogens or man-made accidents or intent spread of things? And will we see, as we suspect, or I certainly suspect, that systemic risk in this area would be rather like in the financial area, where things we don't understand, in that case derivatives and CDOs and other things, lead to transmissions of risks which the institutions we have are simply not set up to understand or manage?
Let me ask Mark the first question and Angela the second, if I could.
Yeah, having spent several years working specifically on biosecurity and bioterrorism, and I had the privilege of having a mentor, Peggy Hamburg, who's now the commissioner of FDA, guiding the efforts in that space. And certainly, you have to have good disease surveillance systems globally, regardless of whether it's an intentional threat, a natural threat, what have you. And I think sometimes we forget that there are 1,500 deaths every day in developing countries from infectious diseases, and half of those are children under five. This is the global community that we are working with when it comes to pandemics, when it comes to bioterrorism. The priorities in these countries of dealing with the burdens of infectious diseases is their everyday reality, while we may have the luxury of thinking about the next pandemic or the intentional threat. And somehow we've got to come together and realize that, you know, it takes more than science, good science, to deal with pandemics. I mean, if it only took science, we wouldn't have an HIV pandemic that's continuing, right, because of lack of political will or human behavior. So somehow we have to, in my opinion, you know, stop labeling these different threats that only pertain through a lens that you're looking through, and somehow get us to the point where when we're talking about infectious diseases, especially things at the epidemic and pandemic level, we're all global citizens in the same pool. And we have to be respectful of the perspective of people who are dealing with, unfortunately, a greater burden of illness on an everyday basis that we may have the luxury of not dealing with, and somehow come to a common ground and how we're going to deal with these efforts moving forward.
Angela, do you want to take part? A moment for applause. I heard some. It's all right.
Angela. I think on the issue of systemic risk in epidemiology versus banking, the information flows the other way around. The way risks spread through the banking sector has been well informed by ideas from biology, and I think there's a lot of intellectual capital to reap there, actually. So, no, I think the flow goes the other way.
So we're now at the last 10 minutes, and here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to have three people ask questions, and then the panel will respond to those three, and we'll see if we can do that round three times to give people a chance if there are still more people who have questions. So let's take three questions if there are. There's one over here. And who's going to be after that? And one over here, Catherine.
In the far back.
Yep.
Thank you. Kevin Braithwaite from Rootspace in Lebanon. Would you mind commenting further on the funding gaps in this area and ways in which we can try and fill those gaps by bringing new sources of capital to the table? Thank you.
Thank you. Funding gaps. Kevin.
So just as a layperson sitting here, I was really relating to what Mark just said about the need to engage in other kinds of solutions. And I'm making a connection between the brain research panel here and the media panel and want to actually say, is there interdisciplinary work going on around risk? And might this forum do some of that next year? I'm wanting the brain researchers to talk about in and out groups sitting at the same table with you guys, with the media people on communication.
Interdisciplinary research on risks. Yes, please. Third question.
I'd like to connect both of these questions. My name is Mitchell Strauss. I'm from a government agency, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. And we have senior debt, maybe some mezzanine debt available to apply to issues such as healthcare. We need two things somehow to be repaid, and we need a U.S. sponsor. But there's money available, just connecting with the other question. Thank you.
Good. We have three questions: funding, interdisciplinary research on risks, and availability of senior debt if it can be repaid with a U.S. sponsor.
Yeah, I'll make a comment about the funding gaps. You know, public health is historically underfunded in probably every country, but I think in regards to some of the discussions we have, certainly, you know, we need, again, this is just my opinion, it would be great to see more funding going to training programs for epidemiology. I mean, we have great models out there. We have the Field Epidemiology Training Program, which, if you don't know about that program, it's a two-year program that's modeled after the Epidemic Intelligence Service program in the CDC. And, you know, we should have at least one robust FETP program in every country. But it's very difficult to argue for that kind of money for training. It's always a hard sell to donors. People see that as capacity building. They see that as the responsibility of governments and not of private donors. Certainly aid agencies support those kind of things. But I think, you know, not only human capacity for epidemiology is needed, but we also need to put money into laboratories. I mean, there are countries in this world that literally don't even have microscopes in laboratories, and simple things like being able to determine whether it's a bacterial infection versus something else, you know, can be done with a simple microscope. So, you know, some of these very basic things, you know, we sort of glaze over into all the high technology solutions, and somebody made a comment earlier, it's not all about the high technology. It's not sexy to think about buying microscopes and putting them into every laboratory in a country, but that could have a greater impact than, you know, some of these higher tech solutions. So I would say human capacity building and laboratory capacity building are greatly underfunded.
Seth?
I mean, we need money for, obviously, health systems and surveillance. We've talked about that. The R&D issue is kind of interesting because there's a lot of money that goes into biomedical R&D, but it's not focused on diseases of poverty. And interestingly, even money in the developing world isn't focused on diseases of poverty because developing world companies want to make products for the developed world. So there's a lot of opportunity to do that. Obviously, the Gates Foundation does that in a big way, but they can't do it alone. And that's something where we can get a lot of, you know, entrepreneurs and a lot of innovation occurring. I just want to go back to Ian's point because what's changed now is people can move around much shorter than incubation period. So in a way, things had spread seriatim before. Mm-hmm. Now they can, you know, somebody going into an airport can infect a plane and it can go in all directions. And what used to happen is people didn't want to talk about it. They were afraid to admit they had a pandemic, an epidemic, and governments were reluctant to talk about it. HIV, you know, country after country didn't want to talk about it. What's really changed is the availability of the internet and democratization of information, as we've heard. And all of a sudden, it becomes much harder to, you know, hold the cap on it. And you understand why a government wants to hold the cap on it, because the economic effects, if all of a sudden you get people to think there's a pandemic or an epidemic going on, could be dramatic. But what we've got to do is have reaction times like that. We're still not there yet. And that's what's going to have to happen, you know, to connect those two.
One of the things that changed is what David and his colleagues did, because prior to 5 years ago, it was against WHO regulations for anyone other than a government to report a communicable disease. Now, that's all been opened up, and any private organization, any social entrepreneur, an NGO can report, and it's actionable. And that changes the dynamics of reporting. Angela?
So I would say for funding gaps, I would say vaccines, actually. I mean, you know, from the point of view of where we've been in the past, vaccines have made so much difference, and there are still so many diseases that if we had good vaccines, the world would be different. Mm. And I think this the idea about interdisciplinary research or an interdisciplinary panel on risk is a terrific idea. I think a real dialogue between scientists and the media about how to talk about risk in ways that are both measured and exciting, because actually all this stuff is incredibly exciting, would be fascinating. Great idea.
Thank you. Let's have one more round of questions, and then I'll ask the panelists to follow it up. Ben, do you want to take one? And we'll do these really quick.
So just really quickly, what are we learning from our work with pandemics that could be applied to a field like climate change? Listening to some of the challenges that are present here, you know, risk uncertainty, you know, faith in scientific conclusions, public will, preparation. I mean, there are so many issues that are crossing over here. Does the panel have any thoughts on how some of the lessons learned here could be applied to the other issue?
Thank you very much. I think your question had a lot of really good answers in it, too.
Hi. Hearing about public education and how that affects people getting vaccinated or misusing antibiotics, what's the gap in public awareness, and who's going to fill that?
Public awareness and the gap. One more question, please.
Following on from that point, my name is Carlo Bellini. I'm a doctor doing the MBA here. Something I found working in a developed country in the time of the crisis was panic amongst the medical specialty, not knowing how to measure risk, but also being unprepared from a culture that really hasn't been taught in education to deal with the pandemic, back from medical student to junior doctor and all other allied health professionals. And how do we create a sense of urgency amongst the health profession now and the wider health profession, the uninformed health profession, to cope when the pandemic does strike in the future, so we are prepared from that perspective?
Preparation, excellent. Let's start with Mark, go the other way around, and use this as an opportunity to address the question or any other concluding remarks that you have.
I couldn't help but think of a story that somebody had told me. She was a first grade teacher, and she was surveying her class about what was their favorite subject, and the young boy said hand washing. And then she realized that that's how much they had ingrained with these kids about washing their hands, that this poor kid actually thought that was a class.
Should be.
But yeah, so maybe that's where we start with awareness, is with young people. There's been a lot of debate in some circles about greater funding to go into training journalists about pandemics and epidemics in a way that is quite interesting, because some of these early systems that we're now relying on for detecting threats are actually coming because we're picking up news stories and other things. So. And then people will criticize journalists as they tell the wrong story or they just invoke fear. And so as a public health person, I see journalists as being a critical component of the public health system. And I think somehow if we could do a better job at realizing that we're great partners in this together, and that there can be a huge asset in having journalists really understand pandemics and understand, you know, what needs to be communicated and how to communicate that, it seems like a really easy win, and one that, you know, there's some programs. I know the Rockefeller Foundation has a program where they're training journalists on pandemics. I know the Knights Fellows are doing some of that stuff, but they're all just done on really small sort of pilot projects or small-scale efforts, and it seems that that would be one way to increase awareness. Obviously, Jeff's comment about, you know, creating greater awareness with films is something that would be terrific. How many people have ever seen the movie Outbreak? And, you know, after that movie came out, everyone talked about that scene in the movie theater where they, you know, showed the person coughing and all the little particles. And we don't really see a lot of that kind of stuff. I'm not saying that that was the right way to educate people, but it was an attempt where people who did see that movie probably talked about outbreaks for the first time. So I think we could get quite creative in that area. But to do something on a large scale with journalists, I think would be an easy win.
I don't know if you know that, I hope Mitch doesn't mind my saying, that his brother has just been through quite a training program, became the head of CDC, and now is a television journalist. So that's a really good training program, and he'll be helping us a lot in the future. Angela?
I'd like to talk about the public awareness question, because I think you could look at it another way and say that if you're raising your kids in a community where vaccination levels are high enough, actually, the rational thing for you to do is selfishly not vaccinate your kids. Mm. Equally, if you have any fear that perhaps you might get a bacterial superinfection on top of your viral infection, the rational thing to do is to take antibiotics. And these things become common pool resources, and they're subject to a tragedy of the commons, because the individual's rational behavior is to use them, regardless of the long-term effects. And I think we need to think that through when we talk about public awareness and education, because people aren't stupid.
Angela, did you know this was being taped for later broadcast, time delay? Seth.
It's just funny, because I wanted to say something that's almost the opposite of what Mark said, so now we can get a real debate going at the end of the time. And that is, I agree with you totally about the role of journalists. One of the biggest problems we have across all fields is scientific denialism, which exists, and policymakers, et cetera. And the way to counter that is better information. Journalist is good, but I can tell you personally, I had a relationship with many of the key science reporters around the world. Anything on AIDS vaccines, they called me. I recently went out to them. I had 14 in my A list of people who I went to first. Of those 14, only two are left.
That's right.
The other 12 have been fired with the downsizing of professional media. Mm-hmm. And of course, what do we have instead? Our blogs. Mm-hmm. And how do you retract from a blog and the misinformation associated? So I actually think we're going backwards. And what we need is credible ways of getting information that's validated, that people will believe about pandemics, versus the, you know, recently in Zambia, there was a microbicide trial that failed, and there was some increased numbers of infections. Well, the headline from the blog coming out of that was HIV vaccine fails and causes infections. Ripple effects around the world. How do you fight that back? So I think we need new tools and new ways to think about that.
David, I think it's fitting that you should have the final word.
Thanks. I'd come back to two issues. One is the vaccine issue, and clearly vaccines are the solution to everything we've talked about in this room, including antimicrobial resistance and hospital infections.
Right.
If you've got the right vaccines, you don't have to worry about the new antibiotics. So we got to get the balance right between our research and development and make sure that we're doing vaccines as well as the drugs. And the second thing is to come back to the intersectorial and interdisciplinary area and funding gaps. You know, today in emerging infections like influenza and others, we're investing in detecting the disease in humans and in responding to that. The next step is to move the paradigm back, and that's beginning with people like Nathan and others to look and see what's available in the menu of animals, what animals are carrying that might spread over to humans. You can't predict which ones will, but you can at least understand what might be there. But then if you could shift the paradigm back even further to looking at wildlife management, at animal management, at the issues which really are causing the infections from wild animals to go to domestic animals, or the other areas back in that area, you'll clearly understand how to prevent all of this from ever happening. So you have to go way back. We're shifting the paradigm back, but we have to shift it way back. And for that, it takes money and it takes brain power. And it takes a willingness to do things that aren't quite as glamorous as responding to an outbreak like the Boy Scouts do, or doing something else along the way. So we have to keep looking back as far as we can go to get the understanding we need to really prevent these things in the first place.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the panelists who did an extraordinary job. I want to thank the organizers who really, especially the ones in orange shirts who brought you here. And I particularly want to thank the audience. You guys were fantastic. Thank you.